Hello, and welcome to the second episode of NLDR, the Narrative Lectionary Podcast for People on the Go. My name is Dr. Amy Robertson, and I'm joined each week by my friend and colleague, Dr. Robert Williamson, for a conversation about how this week's biblical text lives in our minds as Bible scholars, and how it lives in our hearts as people who are deeply enmeshed in our faith communities. Up this week is Genesis 18, verses 1 through 15, and just the beginning of Genesis 21, verses 1 through 7. Our discussion touches on radical hospitality as a response to vulnerability, the question of power dynamics, and who is pushed to the outskirts of important conversations, God's kept promises, and the role of laughter in all of this. Thank you for being with us. Hi, Bobby.
Good to see you again.
It's good to see you too. I've been looking forward to our conversation about Genesis 18.
Me too.
But some things have happened between Genesis 2 and Genesis 18.
So many things.
We're not going to summarize all the things. But what would you pull out as one or two things that you want to be sure people know happened?
I mean, I think in order to understand the context of this story in Genesis 18, we need to talk about Abraham a little bit. And so the covenant that God made with Abraham in Genesis chapter 12 and then has reiterated it a couple of times in Genesis 15 and then Genesis 17, saying that God is going to give Abraham progeny, land, and eventually a nation as plentiful as the stars. And so part of the dynamic of Genesis 12 to 18, which is where we're starting today, is this question of how is Abraham, this 100-year-old man, and Sarah, his 90-year-old wife, how is God going to bring about this promise when they don't have any children and they're past the age of having children? What else would you say about that? Is there more people need to know?
I would add just two things, I think. One is that Abraham has a son at this point in the story. He has a son, Ishmael. It's just Sarah is not the mother of that son. Hagar is the mother of the son. Hagar is a woman who works in their household. So that's sort of another dramatic element. And then just in terms of immediate context, Genesis 18 has this sort of announcement that Sarah is going to bear a child. And that just happened in 17 also.
Right.
So just like when we read the creation story, we started out by saying, we just finished the creation story. And then it launches into the creation story again, but the story is a little different.
Right.
We have the same thing here. We just read a story where Abraham is told by God that Sarah will bear a son, and this will be the son through whom the covenant is kept. And then we're told again in a different way.
Right.
So with that, let's start reading. I am reading from the Jewish Publication Society translation. So, the Lord appeared to him by the terebinths of Mamre. He was sitting at the entrance of the tent as the day grew hot. Looking up, he saw three men standing near him. As soon as he saw them, he ran from the entrance of the tent to greet them, and bowing to the ground, he said, "My lords, if it please you, do not go on past your servants. Let a little water be brought. Bathe your feet and recline under the tree. And let me fetch a morsel of bread that you may refresh yourselves, then go on, seeing that you have come your servant's way." They replied, "Do as you have said." So one thing I want to ask about is sort of where they are. This first verse, the Lord appeared to him at the terebinths of Mamre.
Right.
What are terebinths, Bobby?
Well, the NRSV translation is the Oaks of Mamre.
It's a little easier for English speakers.
Yeah, we have some sort of a tree here. This tree, the terebinth, the oaks at Mamre, are mentioned previously in Genesis chapter 13. This is just after Abraham has arrived in the land and he and his cousin Lot have separated. And Abraham builds an altar at the Oaks of Mamre and then sets his tent there. And so this is both Abraham's dwelling place for the last six chapters, and also there's a religious significance to this site as well.
Yeah, that's really helpful context. It's not just a setting. It's easy to read it sort of just as it was hot, so he was sitting in the shade.
Right.
True.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, these oaks have a little more history than that. So what do you think about the relationship between those first two verses then? The Lord appeared at these trees, and then looking up, Abraham sees three men standing near him.
Right. Yeah. I was going to ask you about this too. But yeah, so there's a couple things to me that are going on there. One is the narrator tells us as the reader that this is the Lord that is appearing. But it's not at all clear whether Abraham knows that or not. Like, as the story goes on, Abraham starts to clue in kind of by the end. He is clearly realizes who he's talking to. But here at the beginning, it seems like we know that these three men are in some way the Lord, but Abraham doesn't know. And so he just sees three men at the oaks there, and he's going to offer hospitality. I've always been puzzled by that. I assume one of the things you're asking me about is if it's the Lord, why is there three people? And, you know, in a Christian tradition, this is one of the kind of great appearances of the Trinity early in the Christian, what we would call the Old Testament. Here is God in three persons kind of walking around. But when you read this in a pre-Christian sense in which it was written, it's less clear why the three men, and yet the text is saying, here's the Lord. I'm curious, as you read this from your both scholarly and Jewish backgrounds, what do you think about those three?
I mean, men? My first thought was there are other places in the Hebrew Bible where the text, a man appeared, and then it sort of turns over into maybe an angel kind right. of character. I think we get to talk about the story of Jacob's wrestling later, but I think that's one of those cases. This sort of, you know, the idea that God may appear through angels that may look like men, and humans don't necessarily can't parse out what's what. Right. Doesn't seem unfamiliar to me.
You know, when I tend to think about it from just an academic scholarly reading of the text, I have sort of settled as there are three figures, three men, one of whom is some kind of manifestation of God, and the other two of whom are angels. And so you have God and his entourage kind of showing up here.
The other thing that this sort of pushes me to remember is just to try to put myself back in the position of what it could have been like to be a traveler at this time in history, you know, where there's no Waffle House and Motel 6 at every stop on the highway. Yeah. And you don't have all of your comfort items in your vehicle right. and have everything planned out. Like, there's a huge amount of vulnerability to be on the road, and you really were at the mercy of the people whose paths you crossed.
Absolutely right.
And it had me thinking about sort of who in our world is that? Who are those vulnerable travelers now? It's not me, you know, driving to visit my family, but there are people in the world who travel on foot with that much vulnerability.
Yeah.
And so that it's not just hospitality that seems a little over the top to me, because truly there was that sense of need and vulnerability.
That's absolutely right. And I read this text last week with my Mercy Church community, who many of them are homeless. They think of themselves as being vulnerable, maybe in the way that you're describing, as these three men who really they're away from their place. They don't have people, they don't have food. And so they're relying in some ways on the hospitality of strangers. And Abraham is standing at his tent door, kind of hoping, it seems like, that someone's going to show up and need hospitality. He's rushing out there and saying to them, like, please, it would be my honor if you would let me serve you in this way. And so I'm going to bring you some food and water, and please honor me by staying in my place. You know, in the contemporary context, that's so often the other way around. That the only way that you get someone to kind of extend hospitality, at least for my friends at Mercy Church, is to go and beg them to, you know, to give you something. And here we have Abraham saying, oh, here are three people. They're in my land. They're by my shrine. And so not only do I sort of owe it to them, but he is honored by this idea that they would stay with him for a little while. It's such an interesting depiction of what hospitality is.
In the Jewish tradition, this, because what happens right before this in the text is that Abraham circumcises himself as a sign of his covenant with God, the Jewish tradition imagines that he is a 99-year-old man who is just circumcised and is healing, is sitting in the shade healing. So it just sort of adds another layer of the extent to which the hospitality is above and beyond.
Yeah. It's interesting to me because the hospitality he initially offers in this part that we've read, it's generous, but it's pretty like reasonable. I'm going to go get you a little bread. I'm going to get you a little water to bathe your feet and just stay here a minute and then go on your way. And then, right. You know, you're kind of alluding to like what he actually ends up doing is quite a different thing.
So let's go on and here, I'll read that next section and we can move into it. Abraham hastened into the tent to Sarah and said, "Quick, 3 seahs of choice flour, knead and make cakes." Then Abraham ran to the herd, took a calf tender and choice, and gave it to a servant boy who hastened to prepare it. He took curds and milk and the calf that had been prepared and set these before them, and he waited on them under the tree as they ate.
So being who I am, I was really curious about what a seah is. And so I looked it up, you know, in the BDB, and it told me that a seah is equal to about 7.5 quarts. And so I'm not a baker. So I was like, well, how much, like, that seems like a lot, but like, really, how much is that? So what I did was I Googled the recipe for Betty Crocker's traditional white bread.
Wow.
And I discovered that you need 3 cups of flour to make a loaf of bread. If you follow Betty Crocker's recipe, as I'm sure Abraham did.
I'm sure
and
that's what Abraham
did. So if what Sarah did was take this flour and make loaves of bread, this would have been 30 loaves of bread or 10 loaves of bread for each of these individuals. Like it's so far over the top. Yeah, it's amazing.
All right, I have to give Abraham a little bit of a hard time here for just a moment.
Yeah.
Let's just clarify. Abraham made this lovely offer to these guests.
Right.
Who then does all the work?
Yep.
It is Sarah and the servant boy.
Yeah.
But who then gets to sit with the guests
right.
and be the hospitable host?
Yeah. Welcome to the patriarchy. Yeah.
Welcome to the patriarchy. Population you.
Yeah. And Abraham.
Mm-hmm. And Abraham and Sarah and the servant boy.
Yeah.
It really is just, you know, it's just an observation.
Yeah. No, it's a good one. And it is true. Abraham takes a lot of credit for a lot of things that he did not do himself. He does carry the yogurt and the milk.
He does. Yes, he does.
So he's
he does carry out the yogurt and the milk. That's good. He doesn't make 30 loaves of bread, but that's
no. Yeah. Fair enough.
But I will say that reading this does make me think about when I am in situations of relative power. When I make offers and who actually winds up
right
doing the work.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah. Give an example of what you mean when you say that.
In my workplace, I supervise a lot of staff and I do speak on behalf of our organization. And maybe that's what Abraham's doing is speaking on behalf of his household. But I need to be mindful when I make offers on behalf of the congregation, who is being impacted in the organization by that offer if I'm not planning to do it all myself.
Very well said.
All right, moving right along. This next scene is weird, Bobby.
It is so weird.
It's really weird. I want to make like a diorama with like little Lego people and like figure out what.
Oh, that would be amazing.
We should do that.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Okay.
They said to him, "Where is your wife, Sarah?" And he replied, "There in the tent." Then one said, "I will return to you next year and your wife, Sarah, shall have a son." Sarah was listening at the entrance of the tent, which was behind him. Now, Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in years. Sarah had stopped having the periods of women, and Sarah laughed to herself, saying, "Now that I'm withered, am I to have enjoyment with my husband so old?" Then the Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh, saying, 'Shall I in truth bear a child, old as I am? Is anything too wondrous for the Lord?' I will return to you at the same season next year, and Sarah shall have a son." Sarah lied, saying, "I did not laugh," for she was frightened. But he replied, "You did laugh." Okay, what are you picturing here? So Sarah's like on the outskirts of the space that they're in, right? Sarah's not sitting with them, but she's, you know, she can hear.
The way that I picture it, like if I were a director who was making the movie of this scene, I would have the men at the tree and then Abraham kind of closer to the tent than they are looking at them, and then Sarah at the tent behind. So she's behind Abraham, who is between her and the men. I'm also not clear whether Sarah is hiding in the tent, like she's behind the tent flap, or whether she is standing in the doorway so that she can be seen.
Well, the men ask where she is.
That's true. So if they could see her.
So they can't see her. And Abraham must not be able to see her because God has to report to Abraham that she laughs.
That's true. Yeah.
I feel like she's so awkwardly in this story and not.
Yeah.
Like she's critical in absolutely every way. This child is going to grow in her body. But she is also left out of the story. She's like lurking in the shadows and sort of listening. And it creates a very awkward situation.
It does. And when the men say, "Where is your wife, Sarah?" Like as a reader, you're anticipating that when Abraham tells them where she is, they're going to go and talk to her.
Or say, "Bring her in."
Right. Yeah. She's going to become part of the story. And instead they say, "Well, okay, well, we're going to come back next year." And so she just gets moved right past. The other thing is she hasn't been in the story. It's not clear that she's been in the presence of the men up until now, or how they know what her name is. Like to me, this is the moment where Abraham clues in, right? Like when they say, "Where is your wife, Sarah?" Like either these guys have been like Facebook stalking him and they like know his wife's name, or they're some kind of godly beings, you know? And so in that way, like invoking her name sort of personalizes her in a way that says, oh, like really these people know who we are.
Yeah. And I mean, so they say she's going to have a baby and she like chuckles to herself,
right?
Which is, you know, of course, an etymology of Isaac means to laugh, right? And she gets kind of in trouble. I mean,
yeah.
I read it as getting in trouble. I don't know if it's not sort of a direct scolding, but there's a report that she did it.
Yeah.
Sort of like this, like tattling sense, but it's weird. It's like God is tattling to Abraham. She laughs.
Yeah.
When, again, in the chapter before this, Abraham falls on his freaking face and laughs.
Yeah. And nobody
he
says anything about it.
And no one says boo about
it. Exactly. Yeah. Or here, there is some kind of, I don't know if it's a rebuke. I was noticing when you read it, you read it as a rebuke, right? Oh, yes, you did laugh. And you kind of like, your eyes had this sort of like probably the look like you give people when they have crossed you in a bad way. which I've never seen before. But you could read it. You could read this as sort of lighthearted of her, like she's nervous. I didn't laugh. She was afraid. But you could read the Lord then as saying, "Oh yes, you did." Like, come on now. Like, let's just don't pretend. And the Bible is so often this way, where a lot is in the tone of how that should be said, but we don't have access to the tone, and so we don't know if this is a reprimand.
Right.
Or just kind of a mutual acknowledgement that there was laughter involved. So you read it as a reprimand, though.
I do. But again, that's when I say sort of like, yes, the English sounds like a reprimand to me. But and then I wonder why was Sarah frightened for having, how did this become such a big deal? And it sort of has me go back again to this thing of like, Sarah is so central to this, but she's not in the conversation. And I just feel like it creates all this weirdness.
There's a couple other things in here that I found really fascinating. And one of them, so God actually misreports what Sarah says when he repeats it. So Sarah says, "Now that I am withered, am I to have enjoyment with my husband so old?" Now, when the Lord then repeats to Abraham what she said, the Lord says, "Sarah, why did Sarah laugh saying, 'Shall I in truth bear a child old as I am?'" But Sarah actually didn't say anything about bearing a child. She said something about having pleasure. And she mentioned Abraham being old, whereas the Lord doesn't repeat that part. And I find that really fascinating. Like the way that I read it is Sarah is saying, my husband is, I don't know what you're going to think about this. My husband is too old to give me sexual pleasure. And so she's laughing about that. And God doesn't want to repeat that to Abraham. And so God sort of changes a little bit to say, like, well, what she said was, am I too old to have a child? How is that possible? And so God has kind of taken this thing about pleasure and about Abraham's age and has turned it to be something about childbearing and Sarah's age. Now, I don't know why. Like, I don't know what to make of that. But that's the way that I read it.
There actually is a passage in the Talmud that talks about that and about sort of the importance of, like, keeping peace in relationships, and says that God intentionally changed it so as not to sow discord between Sarah and Abraham.
So the Talmud then is reading it as what Sarah said was actually kind of offensive to Abraham. And so God cleaned it up.
Didn't want to hurt Abraham's feelings.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
So this is actually where the narrative lectionary ends, right?
Yeah.
For this chapter. Mm-hmm. So let's do 21 and then we can come back. So we're doing just the first 7 verses. The Lord took note of Sarah as he had promised, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. Sarah conceived and bore a son to Abraham in his old age at the set time of which God had spoken. Abraham gave his newborn son, whom Sarah had borne him, the name Isaac. And when his son Isaac was 8 days old, Abraham circumcised him as God had commanded him. Now Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. Sarah said, God has brought me laughter. Everyone who hears will laugh with me. And she added, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would suckle children? Yet I have borne a son in his old age. This to me, this is not a very sophisticated reading, but it reads like, you know what bullet journals are?
You know, I've heard that I should have one, but I don't actually know.
Oh gosh, I have a major fail on bullet journals, but it's like there's a whole Pinterest universe devoted to it. It's just like lists. It's a book of lists, like to-do lists or books you want to read or I don't know, whatever you would make a list of. And it's sort of built around, you make them pretty and then you have the grand satisfaction of tracking and checking off all the things that you've done from your list. Have you ever put something on your list so you could check it off?
Oh, absolutely. I do that all the time.
It's very satisfying. So that's how I read the beginning of 21, is that this is like, check, God gave this son to Abraham and Sarah.
Yeah.
Check. Abraham had the child circumcised. Check, they named the child Isaac. You know, it even comes back to the laughter piece. Just sort of ties the whole thing up nicely. I don't know. Do you see? And so there is, of course, theological significance in the completion of that sort of pericope. Mm-hmm. But I don't have a lot of further comment on that.
Yeah, I think in one sense, like, that's exactly right. Like, we've been following this story arc since Genesis chapter 12, when God shows up and says, I'm going to give you land and progeny. And this whole time, for the last, whatever, 10 chapters, we've been wondering, can God do this? Is God going to do this? How is God going to do this? And here's the moment where it's fulfilled. So in that sense, yeah, I think it is kind of a check. Like, God makes promises and God fulfills promises, even though those promises seem impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But in another sense, one of the things that I was thinking about is this here, Sarah is called forward in the text in a really interesting way to me, because all the promise up to now has been that God's going to do this thing for Abraham. And then now the language is the Lord took note of Sarah as he promised, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. And then she bore a child for Abraham. So in this interesting kind of way, Sarah seems to become the partner in the fulfillment of the covenant. And Abraham, just for a second, has kind of receded in importance.
In my mind, it becomes related somehow to the fact that there's no weirdness around her laughing anymore. Like that she's, I don't know if it's sort of a question of when people are pushed to the outskirts of conversations, you sort of make assumptions about them or they make assumptions about you, or it's just sort of easy to misread each other. And now that Sarah is sort of central, there seems to be no tension at all with the fact that she laughed. It's a joyful laugh. And like, everyone will laugh with me. This is the craziest thing that has ever happened.
Yeah.
And you should laugh because it's surprising.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons why I kind of want to go back then to chapter 18 and read God's response to Sarah as a little like jovial itself, to say like, oh, yes, you did laugh. with the sense of like, of course you laugh, like everyone's gonna laugh, like that this is a crazy situation. And so I think that the laughter, and I mean, one of the, like, as you were saying before, the name Isaac, Yitzchak, is so he will laugh, which could be a reference then to Abraham's laughter in chapter 17, or to Sarah's laughter in chapter 18, or probably to both of those. And then I was thinking about, you know, in this really interesting kind of way, you know, the God of the Hebrew Bible comes to be referred to as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so in this kind of, once they name the kid Isaac, then that notion of laughter gets taken up into an identifier of God as well. So there's this kind of sense in which God becomes identified with laughter, or with doing things that are like laughably crazy, like so beyond the pale of what you think is possible that you can't help but laugh when you hear about them or something.
That's really interesting. I like that.
One of the things that I was wondering about this, your perspective, is this text is making a big deal about a woman who is beyond the age of childbirth, who then reaches some kind of fulfillment by having a child. I mean, as you know, this is a repeated theme in the Hebrew Bible. It's going to be true of Rebecca. It's going to be true of Rachel. It's going to be true of Hannah. In the New Testament, in a different kind of way, it's going to be true of Mary. And so I was just, I mean, I think the point of that motif, as I understand it, is here is something that has come to fruition that could not have happened if God had not intervened. These couples could not have had children themselves. And so that they did means the continuation of the line is divine providence. And there's something really beautiful about that idea. But at the same time, I wonder if, as for modern readers listening, especially for modern women listening to that text in this kind of sense in which it's childbirth that brings wholeness or something like that. And if there has not been a child, then there's something lacking from the picture. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about how do we deal with a text like this in our communities? I mean, we have women who have all sorts of relationships to childbirth. They have children, they want to have children, but haven't been able. They've decided not to have children. Mm-hmm. They've lost children. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts about how we think, or what we should keep in mind as we read a text like this in our own communities?
Gosh, that's such a good question. And I haven't thought a lot about, or haven't heard a lot of discussion about the perspective of women who don't want to have children. Right. And that's not part of the story that they would write for themselves. What I have mostly heard is women who have been unable to have children, but want to have children, biological children, and how these stories resonate for them, both in terms of the sense of yearning and how they relate to the yearning of the quote-unquote barren women, but then also, you know, like sometimes they don't get that miracle that you get in the biblical text. And so what is it becomes very easy to read so much meaning and really in terms of like your relationship with God and the importance of your role in the world, whether or not your prayers for children are heard. And so I mean, I think that's a struggle, certainly in this area reading the biblical text, but also many others. You know, like this is not something that's limited to this particular life experience in the way that we read the biblical text.
There is a tendency in all kinds of ways, I if I understand where you're pointing to when you read these stories, they're about promises fulfilled. But many of us, most of us, have also experiences promises unfulfilled, or at least promises deferred. And so when we read stories about God following through, and our own experiences about being let down or being unsure where the fulfillment might come from, like it does create a tension with these stories. That, you know, in my context, so a lot of folks in my community have had really hard lives, and for them, you know, these stories always stand as this recognition that even though God has not yet made their difficult lives better or like brought them to some kind of completion, that there's always this sense that it's, you know, it's on the way, right? Like Abraham waited till he was 100, Sarah waited till she was 90. Mm-hmm. Like it's mm-hmm. gonna come, and it might not be in the way that you expect. So that kind of theology of promise, yet future promises, there is always a future promise. And both Judaism and Christianity in their own ways kind of lean into that in the religions as a whole, that there is some kind of future that is out there, not just for us as individuals, but for us as communities as well. So maybe these stories kind of point in that direction. But at the same time, mm-hmm. we do have to, I think, take seriously that sense that people who are hearing these texts interpreted are often in situations where they're not experiencing that kind of in this present moment.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so they may be, you know, more drawn to characters like Hagar, who it doesn't work out so easily for Hagar and Ishmael. But the fact that those stories are included too sometimes makes people, at least in my community, feel seen and heard in some way, even if they're not offered resolution. They feel less alone in their suffering because it's sort of, there's a shared communal story of this suffering that they're experiencing. So as we bring this week of the narrative lectionary to a close, what do you want to pull out? What kinds of themes do you see that actually play out in your community of faith today?
So in my community, I've mentioned a couple of times, but the place where people really connected to this text is the issue of hospitality. And the way in mm-hmm. which Abraham goes and finds people to be hospitable to, he doesn't wait for people to come to him. And he makes a small but kind offer, and then he exceeds the offer by a magnitude. And so in my community, that notion that hospitality could be offered that way and could be received that way has been really interesting. And so for my other communities, my upper middle class Presbyterian church, in my mind, the challenge of this text is along those same lines, which is how can we be places that truly offer hospitality, not simply to the people who come and ask for it, but how can we be mm-hmm. sort of bearers of hospitality into the world in a little bit extravagant ways, right? So not just the sort of bare minimum of offering, but something that is significant and substantial, and not to people we know or because we think we're going to get something out of it, but to strangers that sort of happen across our way. One of the things I love about this text, and goes back to the very beginning of our conversation, is in my reading anyway, Abraham doesn't know who these three are at the beginning of the story. And so he just sees three people and he goes and he serves them. Serving the stranger suddenly then becomes the serving of God directly, even though he didn't know that's what he was doing. We see that kind of theme in the New Testament. It's taken up famously in the New Testament book of Hebrews, which says one ought to serve strangers because in so doing, you might serve angels unaware. I think the author of Hebrews is probably thinking about this text. What about you? What do you see when you look at this text?
I think a lot about Sarah in this text. I think a lot about Sarah in all the Sarah texts, but I think my thinking is also sort of influenced by what comes next when, you know, Abraham takes Isaac up to the mountain and nearly sacrifices him. And in the meantime, Sarah right. doesn't know what's going on. She's in her tent. And then she dies in the chapter after that. And there's a midrash that she dies of sort of shock and heartbreak to know what right. Abraham was up to. So I guess I sort of read that sort of back into some of these stories and see just a lot of questions about who is at the table and mm-hmm. who is pushed to the outskirts and who is really being impacted by the conversations and the decisions that mm-hmm. are being made at that proverbial table. So I said earlier, when I see things in the biblical text that just sort of make me squirm a little bit, I mean, it is what it is. It's in the text. So what do I do with it now as a modern person? And I try to find places in the world where mm-hmm. that's happening now. Because I want the biblical text to be this ideal. And if there are places where it makes me uncomfortable, then where can I find it now and what can I do about it? So again, it really sort of pulls me back to this question of, you know, in what ways do issues of gender or race or class impact who gets to be in those central conversations versus who the decisions are really mm-hmm. going to impact.
I really like that. Lots of great things to think about there. So Amy, it's been really fun talking with you again.
It is always a pleasure.
Look forward to seeing you again next week.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of NLDR, the Narrative Lectionary Podcast for people on the go. We'll be back again next week to watch Jacob as he wrestles and receives a new name in Genesis 32. I hope you'll join us.